So one of the themes of today's presentations, I hope that you're getting, all joking aside, that you're coming to is these are very complex interactions and they're not easy to get to a point of developing a sense of understanding. And there are the issues of collecting the data, there are the issues of GBIE, there are the issues of trying to translate that through into phenotypes in unknown environments. And so Scott today is going to be talking about, I'm not exactly sure what he's talking about, something about genotype by environment interactions. The intent was to start getting into plant breeding programs. This is a plant breeding. C1 is plant breeding and genetics division. How do you go from some really cool and interesting science, how do you start translating this in a private sector program? And now, with Scott's presentation, getting more, this happens to be a public sector program. How do you start using this information for crop improvement? So, Scott, thank you very much for coming.
Okay. Thanks, Mitch. No, it's all right. I put my black T-shirt on because I like the disembodied head and that Mark had during his talk, and I thought, I'll make that. So the reason I put this up was to demonstrate how poor CSIRO was at formatting presentations back in 2000. So don't worry, I'm not going to stick with this colour scheme. But I just wanted to bring this to your attention. I did actually talk about this 14 years ago, and I think it was in freezing cold Minneapolis and with Mark when he was still at UQ. And these were the conclusions we came up with at the time. We were looking at drought environment types driving fixation of alleles in an example situation. And that we thought it would be useful to be able to combine the crop and genetic simulation models together. And one of the things that we talked about was the fact that with an additive model, if you weren't assuming that the biology was in between, then the alleles would be more or less fixed at the same rate, whereas if we ran them through the biological model, you would get conditional variation in the rate at which alleles were fixed, depending on what trait they were associated with. Anyway, we did publish it, but in agronomy journal, because the agronomists invited me to give the talk. So maybe a few crop scientists and breeders can go back to 2003 agronomy journal and read that. But I think Mark's given us a very nice example that in the 14 years since, or 15, or 16, or whatever since we started it, that you know there was a nice example just given that we could actually do this. Of developing simulations of gene effects on yield. We could do it through building better models, informing them with QTL type experiments or now GWAS experiments, and we needed computing power to do it. I mean, at the time we did that work, it took us about 3 months to get the simulations done, and now we can do them in about 30 minutes. So we do. Anyway, this is my new, you can see our new improved presentation template. People can see it. And this is joint with David Jordan and Graham Hammer. And I'll mention some other people later in the talk. So fortunately in Australia, water is limiting. Fortunate if you're a physiologist or a modeler, because it makes it a lot easier to build models. The water demand is driven very much by characteristics of the sorghum crop, the maturity tillering and the leaf transpiration rate that Mark mentioned, and the management. So you can see this as a nice example here, and I mentioned this, my apologies to people who saw a talk I gave yesterday where I already discussed this, but you see this big gap in here, that's actually soil. And a US physiologist might say, well, that's a huge waste of radiation. But in fact, those plants that are growing in a double skip formation, and this is in Western Queensland, they'll only yield 2.5 to 3 tonnes. But the thing is, the roots are growing underneath that soil and they're using the water in there. If we grow them at solid, so these treatments over here, they will probably yield near zero because they'll use the water too quickly. So water supply is the other part of the equation, the rainfall, soil storage, root exploration and management, and the timing. So the key drivers are timing of canopy and root development. So we try to think about how plants are controlling this water productivity across scales. How does the management interact with the... There is a mouse here, isn't there? Is it that? Oh, you've got to play with that little red thing. Yeah, because the pad doesn't seem to. Oh, okay. You've got to hit it. You've got to be a bit firm. So the you've got the interaction of the management, the environment, and the genotype again was illustrated a bit earlier. But the genotypic effects have been realised at cellular or organ levels, for example, for tillering, and that's all feeding back into the management environment. So we've written a few papers on discussing that scaling issue and the non-linear process in the past. So we capture all of this physiology into APSIM. The latest paper on APSIM has just come out. And it has, I know, again, for crop scientists or particularly breeders, that's probably not in your reading list, environmental modelling and software, but I'd encourage you to go and have a look at it because it's the best summary we have of APSIM right now. And we did put a nice section in there, I think, summarising a lot of the genetics work and how we delivered that. There's over 6,500 citations of APSIM and about 400 or 500 current users. But most of those users are using them for systems applications and only a few of them for genetics, including ourselves. So as Jiming was pointing out, we need to try and get the right combinations of genotypes and management in the target population of environments, given the resources that are limiting, and try to build efficient searches. So breeding is a search on a landscape, as Mark had pointed out, and you can refer back to a book of presentations that were given at ICRISAT back in 94, I think it was, and then published in 96. And we've spending our time trying to work out how to sort of navigate on this virtual landscape as well as try to understand by understanding the models that are behind the adaptation of sorghum in this case. So a large chunk of this presentation is really not a repeat, well, it is a repeat, of a presentation that Graham put together in Interdrought last year, and that's just been published in, again, another obscure journal called Crop and Pasture Science. So if you can't get it, it's according to the website, it's $25. It's only Australian dollars, so I'd encourage you to spend it. But we can perhaps arrange a copy if some of you want a copy, just send me an email. So what we want to do in this talk was look at simulating G by E by M across the production region and think about whether we need a specific adaptation for different parts of that production region. The management of row configuration and density, I already mentioned the adaptation for row configuration. And the genotypic attributes we looked at were maturity, tillering, and root system architecture. And the environment attributes are the six regions that we work with. So we use 24 locations in those regions and 100 years of historical climate to do the work, as well as looking at sowing date and starting salt water. So thinking about the management attributes, these are just two graphics, and no, our model's not actually running these simulations of architectural development of the canopy, but we do capture that through the extinction coefficient and through the weight that the roots grow. It's trying to capture the fact that the skip row systems are saving water by allowing the roots to explore a greater area. And there's obviously an interaction for the canopy development depending on what your maturity is and what the tillering characteristics are of the genotype you're looking at. So this has all been validated and tested in field experiments. This is an example of a rainout shelter in Warwick where the work was done to measure how far out from the rows the sorghum could actually extract that water. So this has all been validated for different germplasm. And this is an example of the two-dimensional root water extraction model in APSIM. And you can see if you run simulations of this, that if you ran a solid plant through a season, this is a terminal water stress. I can't quite get that. I'm going to go for this one. Here we go. So if you follow the bottom line there, that's the available soil water from a solid planting, and through a terminal stress. So these little blips that are going up is where rain has occurred, and above that is the effect of a double skip. So you can see that it's conserving water early in the season for use later. So the solids are running out of water during, well, early grain filling. So it really has a lot of trouble filling the grain. Another characteristic that we look at is maturity and tillering. So these are some examples of the different total leaf number and leaf appearance rates that are occurring in different germplasm. That's capturing the canopy side or the demand side of the water. And you can look at interactions of these different configurations. For example, if you look at standard yield driven by a medium cultivar, the standard density and solid plant, please note that the standard density is only 50,000 plants per hectare. I don't know what that is per acre, but 5 plants per square metre. And if you look at a high input strategy where you put in a late cultivar and push the density up compared to the standard, there'll be years where you lose. This is in one location. There'll be years where you lose and there'll be years where you gain a lot. If you take a much more conservative strategy, a low input strategy, you will obviously lower the average yield, but in these years where the standard crop would fail or be very low yielding, you'll maintain a yield, but you'll never get over about 4 tonnes per hectare in this particular location. Vijaya Singh, who's at the University of Queensland at Quaffey with Graham, has done a lot of fantastic research on root angles. So Vijaya's done the study to show the germplasm variation for this. There are also studies on the QTL effects of the root angle. And this captures this water hunting capability of the different sorghums, and we're able to, in the model, capture its interaction with the different management strategies. So just an overview of the sorghum area. This is the rainfall, about 400 millimetres per year, with a yield of 0.5 to 6 tonnes per hectare. And we're looking at these 6 different regions spanning about 1,200 kilometres north to south in the eastern part of Australia. So if you were to look at the entire sorghum region and you apply the standard management, we can calculate for all of the locations, planting dates, starting soil waters, and all of the genotypes that we ran. So we ran a panel of these genotype traits, just varying the 3 traits. This is the kind of effect that you'll see. You get this yield and risk trade-off, and the genotypic attributes of the best genotype, if you look across all of those combinations, this is the trade-off between yield and risk of failure. So it's the sort of the frontier of profit or productivity. The best attribute across the best genotype attribute across all those is early to medium maturity with medium to high tillering and a narrow root angle. So it's actually hunting water quite vigorously downwards in a standard kind of a management. So, but if you look at the G by E landscape for a year, so this is in just with traits on the X and Y axes, the tillering and maturity and yield going up, you can see this interaction that I mentioned for solid plant and double skip. If you take a solid plant and you end up going over the edge of this boundary when you've got high numbers of tillers and you've got late maturity. That's in one location in Emerald, and this is what the entire panel looks like. I haven't got time to go into the details here, but the 4 dimensions of these plots are maturity, tillering, and then going up and down here is the maximum transpiration rate, which is like a transpiration efficiency, and going across here is root angle. So you can see that the best genotype out of all of these combinations of 4 traits, if David Jordan was able to explore his whole germplasm at once, the best genotype in a solid plant might be located here in the landscape, whereas in a double skip it would be a different genotype. And if you start looking at 10 years at Emerald, you start to see this landscape is shifting around. And in fact, the analogy that Graham and Mark used, particularly in the 2006 paper, was not landscapes, and they used oceans, which I think are actually much better because we're trying to write an ocean rather than a landscape. It's changing so much from year to year. So let's look at specific adaptations in the subregions. Now, if we split into these different regions, these are colour-coded by different population and different configuration of the rows. What's the global genotype adaptation? And you know, going from the global to the local management, what do we need to do? Well, in central Queensland, the northern zone, the same genotype combination and management combination is still on the right part of the frontier. If you shift into some of these other locations, you either increase the density or decrease the density, and you might shift to a single skip. So if you're just using that global genotype, medium tillering, medium maturity, then you need to change the management as you go into those regions if you want to stay right on the edge of that risk frontier. And then if you want to see how you would deal with local G and local M, you might have to make some different changes. Sorry. So if you allow the genotype to vary as well, then in central Queensland, you can get a little bit further up the frontier if you change the tillering. So, but then you need to change the density as well. So if we were looking at one genotype and local management in central Queensland, you would just use that genotype. But if you want to get better adaptation, you would actually push the density up and push the tillering down in that particular location. And these are the changes in the other locations. So there are various combinations of fine-tuning these different combinations of management and genotype characteristics. So the implications of this are that we can, with specific adaptation, we can increase the yield and we can reduce the risk. Now, from a practical point of view, it's not that easy to do. It's only 3 million tonnes of sorghum being produced, so the market's not big enough for the companies to really extensively test and focus on these things. But this gives us opportunities to see, well, there may be some of those locations where specific genotype adaptation can be worthwhile, but it has to be combined with the right management. So the management's got to change. It can't be just one recipe for this adaptation. And I guess some of the other things that we've been looking at, apart from the fact that the value of this all changes depending on the mix of environment types — I didn't talk in detail about environment types, I'll mention something in a minute — but the reason that these are changing is that the combination of the genotype and the management is producing a particular drought stress pattern through the season, and that's what's impacting on the yield. And so you're really trying to manipulate that drought stress pattern to maximise your probability of success. And I guess the other information that we're interested in is making predictions that are conditional on the soil water content at sowing. So in Australia, the sorghum growers will only plant if they've got a minimum amount of soil water, because most of the soil water's got to be stored before you plant. You don't plant on a 10 or 20% full profile. And we've also got ENSO indicators or El Nino indicators that help us predict what the season will be and whether you would choose this genotype and that management to do it. And I've left a quote down here, but in fact this one's from Hammer. So if you don't really understand it, you can't model it. But if you don't model it, you can't really understand it. And that's sort of the driving principle of it. It does mean that we have lots of long conversations drinking coffee or beer or Graham's preferred red wine, and I think that's a good enough reason to adopt that philosophy. I did want to mention a little bit more, because I have a bit of time, I think, Mitch, have I? You're talking next. The chair is speaking next. I just wanted to mention, we deliberately didn't spend a lot of time talking about examples where we've used the genetic value directly in assessing all of this, because I think Mark covered that very well in a previous discussion, but these are some of the references that, again, in the usually obscure journals. I can tell you what they are. AJR used to be the Australian Journal of Agricultural Research, but has now become Crop and Pasture Science, but it's still perhaps not on the subscriptions of some of the some of the institutions here. But behind all of this work, I just showed you what happens when we just choose different values for traits related to sorghum. So we used sort of on a scale for maturity or on a scale for tillering, we just sampled 5 or 10 steps across that. But we're now in a better position to put genetic information into there. And just to give you some more background on this from David Jordan's work, David's done built up back cross NAM populations. He's got more than 100 now with crazy materials like this arundinaceum, where he produces an F1 that looks like this, and he manages to produce back cross progeny that look rather normal. And David's done quite a bit of research in this area. For example, with mapping of flowering time, he during the selection, he deliberately removed the major effect genes for photoperiod sensitivity, so in the F2 and F3, he cleaned those out, which gave him some fun times in trying to do the statistical analysis, because he had a lot of selective driving of the population that he had to adjust for. But he's got a very large amount of phenotypic data and was able to identify 40 QTL across 24 of these BC NAM populations, and most of the effects were smaller than 2 days, and they were very consistent with the work that Ed Buckler published in maize. And in fact, 75 of the markers were associated with maize flowering time, and a fairly extraordinary 90% of the QTL were within 10 centimorgans of the maize QTL. And if you want to read a bit more about that, then have a look at the paper from Emma Mace and David on that. These are the QTL effects from the different populations, so you can see that most of them are quite small, and most of the genotypes that were realised through this process, I mean, they were all selected to have the right kind of, the populations were selected to have an adaptation to our environments, and so they had a very big mixture of these early and late alleles. And just to mention a little bit more on the QTL for root angle, Vijaya spent 3 years doing a PhD detecting these root angles in the biparental population, and in less than a week, using this BC NAM resource, David was and Emma were able to do a nice analysis of these root angle QTL and identify a lot of impacts on yield from the BC NAM resource. So this is the type of information that we're now putting in to drive the trait parameters that are in the model, so that we can navigate on a genotypic landscape to do that. And if I refer back again to some of the older papers we've done on this, this was a combination of combining APSIM with QGene, which had been developed by Dean Podlick and Mark Cooper at UQ, and using QGene as a way of exploring different breeding strategies, and APSIM as a way of calculating the phenotypes that we drive from the QTL information and the trait understanding that we have. So these were another couple of slides I threw in. I suppose what we're now trying to do, this happens to be wheat, not sorghum, you'll be glad to know. We're now, I guess, embarking on a process of trying to use field phenotyping information as a way of informing us better about the variation in these populations, and feeding that through our simulation models. And we're able to use our, well, actually, I'm not allowed to use my UAV just at the moment. I've been grounded, not because I did anything wrong, but because research in Australia has now been categorised as commercial, and we're still negotiating with the government about being able to fly. But I think the fact that we have the G20 in Brisbane maybe made us a little bit more aware of that. So apparently it's next week, so maybe I'll be able to fly again next month. So I just wanted to add a couple of general points in the summary, and I haven't talked about this, but I thought it's worth mentioning to the greater audience. Is really, I've focused on prediction of trait value, G by E by M, and the fact that you can do specific experiments to understand these global coefficients, and Mark gave some examples of those where you might use greenhouse information. Jerry talked about it yesterday as well. You might use greenhouse experiments to inform understanding of certain phenotypes, and that information can then be used in the models. And I guess one of the traps that I often find, and this happens with all kinds of physiologists and breeders is, particularly when they get to the field, as soon as they grow a trial, and so we might do trials with irrigated wheat, and so in wheat in Australia we've been able to very efficiently use transpiration efficiency as a trait of adaptation in wheat, and that's selected from young wheat plants that are only about 6 weeks old. We take the samples at that time, and that's the time at which we phenotype them. But there's always a tendency for people... There's always a tendency for when someone grows that experiment where they phenotype this transpiration efficiency in seedlings, they always say, especially if they're breeders, oh, I want to grow it to yield. And I say, no, don't bother. I mean, you're not interested in yield in this particular trial, because we're actually trying to grow an irrigated trial to estimate a phenotype, but that phenotype is to be used for prediction in drought environments. So, in fact, it's the multi-location trials where that information is going to be relevant. It's not going to be relevant in that irrigated trial at all. So I think you have to certainly be careful that when you're trying to build this kind of understanding, it has to be done in the context of you do experiments that are specifically about phenotyping traits that you need to understand, and those same experiments are not necessarily at all relevant in measuring your end product of yield or whatever you're trying to breed for. And just to mention briefly the other things that we've worked on over a long period of time, environment characterization, using models as virtual checks and environment indices. I didn't talk about that today, but you can refer back to some other work we've done on that. I did mention how we're now trying to connect high throughput phenotyping methods, a bit like the one that Maria talked about as well, to calculate virtual phenotypes in our breeding trials. And I just mentioned the G by E by M landscapes, which Mark gave an example for, to understand genetic trait value, which helps you decide what's the right breeding strategy to proceed with. And with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention, and maybe there's a question or two. Oh, that's a tough question. That's a very good question, James. I've had this experience in sugarcane and wheat, actually, where we, well, and sorghum as well. I mean, David tends to run most of his breeding in a solid plant, and it's the early generation selection is being driven by that. I've had more arguments with wheat breeders about it, actually. There's been a lot of physiological research, where, and particularly recently in Australia, where people have started to look at G by E by M. They got all excited about it, and we were doing it for 15 years, I guess. But so they take the current germplasm, and then they try to test it for that. Okay, well, hang on a minute. The breeder's already fixed it for the management that they targeted. So if you want to understand it, you have to go back to the F2s and produce your own germplasm under a different selection regime if you really want to test it. So part of the issue with understanding G by E by M is that if you've driven it all through a certain management, you may or may not have a linear effect when you change the management. And certainly for sorghum and water supply, it's a non-linear effect. So they really have to go hand in hand. But it doesn't mean that you have to run your breeding program under both types of management, because you can't double your resources or triple your resources. But you may want to be carrying some germplasm through based on phenotypes, even if it's under solid plant, that you think have a particular adaptation to a different management, and you can pick that up a little bit later in the program. It's more trying not to chuck things out quite so early. So.
Thank you.
thanks, Jenny. I'm sorry you invited into this particular talk. I'm sure we could have found an easy one.
Scott, so there's lots of people here that are interested in phenotyping.
Were they there yesterday when I talked?
And there's an interest in, you know, how do you, you know, what are the things you got to be thinking about as you go from UAV collected data, tractor collected data, hand collected data, Levitech collected data? What do people need to be thinking about? And just, do you have any quick advice about what are those big issues that population and environment and management?
I think it's about relevance and understanding the trait and the adaptation. I think I said in a talk yesterday that, and Graham's point summarises it really, that if we can't think about how a trait fits into our model of understanding, if not the physical model that we're using, APSIM, then we probably don't want to measure it. So that's probably the main criteria, is if you've got a great technology to measure a trait, and you don't have a way of explaining how that trait should propagate its effect through to yield in a very clear way, then don't measure it. Measure something else. The problem is a lot of the things that we can measure are things that seem to be quite amenable to these fancy technologies. So, but I'm having the same discussions with lots of my colleagues. It's not like we're all converted.
Okay. Thank you very much, Scott.